Blog Talk Radio. With God's name, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer, welcome to Religion Means Alive. I am your guest host, or I guess I should say hostess, Coral Kadar, and I'm sitting in for Imam Alfred Mohammed. Interestingly, I am not going to be depriving you of your normal host because I have the honor of interviewing the founder and original host of Religion Means Alive today, Imam Alfred Mohammed. I want to tell you that I am so excited. I've been looking forward to this interview since we discussed it about a week ago, and I've been putting together all kinds of intriguing questions for Imam Alfred, and I'm trying to make sure that we make some room for some of your questions. So please give us a call at 805-727-7013. Don't be shy. Let's get you on the board so we can hear what you have to ask Imam Alfred Mohammed. And don't be afraid of asking some of those questions that you're normally not comfortable asking, because I spoke to him before the show and I asked him, Imam Alfred, is there anything that's off limits? Is there anything that you don't feel comfortable answering? And he said, you know what? I like to clear the air. So some of you out there know Imam Alfred and know him to be very outspoken and know him to be somewhat of a character, I think some of us think. But we know him best of all as the host of Religion Means Alive, which is a show that uses a unique voice to try to bring some current issues affecting the human family, the African-American community, bring those issues to the fore and have people address them in new ways. We know Imam Alfred as a strong student and supporter of the late scholar and reformer, and I like to say revitalist, Imam Warithi Muhammad, who is the leader, really, for the new American Muslim thought. And not so much that it's new thought, because we know that many of us considered Imam Muhammad a fundamentalist in the sense that he stuck to the fundamental, simple precincts of our faith, and he made sure that Islam was digestible for every human being. And so we think we need that kind of clear voice in the world today, and we know that Imam Alfred is somebody that really champions the cause of getting that leadership out. Also, we know that Imam Alfred has been a very outspoken person for any cause that has to do with uplifting the condition of African Americans and human beings, of course, but just being sure that we are addressing the concerns that affect the African American community. And we know the issues that affect us are great. One of the issues that Imam Alfred has championed, which is an issue that I also hold very dear, is the issue of violence and gun violence in the African-American community. That violence really reflecting a massive mental health issue. And also we know that the violence that is perpetrated against our young men and our young people from those who have been sworn in to protect the law. Unfortunately, we know that there are mental health issues that have to be addressed among those officers as well. So Imam Alfred is always, very vocal about what we need to do to address some of those concerns. I want you to know that when Imam Alfred comes on, I want to give you a little bit of background on some of the people that he has interviewed on his show. He has interviewed so many interesting people, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And we know that he has had interviews with the Wali Akbar, the editor, former editor of the Muslim Journal. He has interviewed Wali Muhammad, who was the grandson of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and we know him as a communicator, as a pioneering Muslim communication expert and radio host. We know that he has interviewed Les Payne and Bishop Donnie Hilliard. He's also interviewed the mayor of New York, Roz Baraka. Some of you have heard him interview some of our young imams that are up and coming, like Wazir Ali and Imam Asiya Muhammad, and I think just last week, Imam Abdul Latif. We know that Imam Alfred has been somewhat of a historian, trying to put in perspective issues that affect the African American community, and he has made sure that we don't forget some of our beginnings in education. And one of the people that he interviewed is Dr. Jecht, who was the biographer of Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays, who was the founder of Morehouse College. So what I find very intriguing about Imam Alfred is that he projects the valuable spiritual message of religion, quote unquote, but he also make sure that we keep in our focus the concerns of African American people. And I guess that's what he means when he says religion means alive. He's trying to reflect that religion is not just about spiritual matters, it's about making our communities better. The mayor of Newark, New Jersey, I'm sorry, I'm being told that I described him as the mayor of New York. Sorry, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, Mayor Roz Baraka. But in any case, we're waiting for Imam Alfred to come on the line and sign in with us. I want to share with you that Imam Alfred told me that he remembers having a conversation with his own grandmother about the end of slavery, about the end of the Civil War. And this is a very interesting subject. I think we could actually do a full show just on that. We know that Imam Alfred had gotten involved with the civil rights movement as a young man and came close with many of the prominent civil rights leaders. And he was actually ordained as a young minister, I think at 7 or 8 or 9 years old, as was the practice of some Baptist communities. So we can see why he's so vocal and so fiery in his delivery. I want to tell you that I do believe we have Imam Alfred Muhammad on the air. And are you there, Imam Alfred Muhammad?
Yes, I am. Thank you, and peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience, and assalamu alaikum. I say peace be on our honorable, noble listening audience, because we have a large audience that is non-Muslim, and this show is really designed for those persons to acquaint them first with Al-Islam and to recover from the effects of slavery. Those are our taglines. Yes, ma'am. Thank you, and thank you so much, Sister Coral Kadar, for your hosting the show. And we were busy working today, so we apologize to our audience for being late. Were you able to hear me? Yes, Sister Kadar, could you hear me?
So I got to sign back in. Imam Alfred? Hi, we're having some technical difficulties. If you hold on just a minute, we'll be back on the air. Hold on. afternoon, Alfred.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
I did not hear you. I'm so sorry to our guest audience. I'm new.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Yes, ma'am. I'm back, and as I was stating earlier, I'm happy to be the guest hosted by you, and I'd like to have guests to ask questions. I think we should, and as a part of forming a democracy, we have to be informed, and, you know, people who serve us, I don't like the term leader so much, as servants of our community, we should be in a position to answer the audience question. Yes, ma'am.
You got this one. You got this.
I can hear you, but to the audience, just be patient. I think the audience are, we'll get it together. We'll be okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm so sorry. I think we are having some technical difficulties.
I can hear you.
Well, I'm talking on a phone line and not on the board. So
okay, well, I can hear you. If you speak in the phone, if you're speaking for the phone, I can hear you. So if I'm hearing you, the audience is hearing you.
Okay, well, I've got my phone now instead of the board, so because it says the host is signed out. So let me ask you this. I told the host, the audience, that we have had the pleasure of inviting you and that call in and ask anything they wanted to ask. And I started off describing some of the people that you've interviewed, and I mentioned that one of the things that I think about when I think about your work is that you are really a balance between somebody that's promoting religion for helping people to realize their best potential, but also you always keep in focus African-American struggle and what's going on in our neighborhoods. You want to talk to us a little bit about how your radio show addresses those
things? Yes, ma'am. I would really must be very honest with our audience and tell you that I really was influenced by a lot of private conversations I've had with Imam Muhammad, when he said he would wanted to be able to go and speak to an audience and never mention Allah, never mention his messenger, never mention al-Islam, never mention any of the language, but everything he would be doing would be that. So I had tried to learn how to translate language, our religious language, into a common language, because I know that there are a lot of people who are alienated from the church. There are many of them alienated from the mosque, synagogue, that's alienated from religion, period. So we have to learn a language that's common to them. So I use a lot of social science language. I use a lot of language about historical, but I don't ever kid the audience who I'm targeting. I'm targeting the people who, in my opinion, and very informed opinion, I must say, due to the fact that I am the grandson of a slave. I'm not three generations removed. Lula Nallen was a slave on the Nallen Plantation in Appomattox County, Virginia. And also being the son of Lynchburg, which was named for the Lynch Law, I have to work with the victims. I don't say victims, but certainly the people who have suffered the worst. So I tell audiences wherever I speak. I just left Union Seminary a few minutes ago, and I was late coming here, and I explained to the people, I don't make any hesitation or apology for targeting a particular audience just as a physician would. You come into an emergency room, you have a heart attack, and there's another guy has a laceration. They're going to take the guy with the heart attack or the asthma. It's triage. So I want to say that because my first love was never ministry. My first love was really medicine. And I tried for maybe 40 years of my life to get into medicine, and Allah just placed me right here. And as a result of that fact, I was heavily influenced by what I call the preacher-scholar traditions in African-American life. And you can ask me questions about that and those influences upon my life later on during the course of our broadcast.
Well, I have a feeling that we're going to wind up doing more than one interview with you because just the discussion of you're talking about the fact that you are connected to your grandparents who were slaves. You know, it came to my mind that so many people talk about slavery in a way that it seems no longer relevant. In other words, why are you even talking about slavery as if it's still relevant when so many people are saying, oh, the African-American community should have gotten over that?
I had to understand my dear beloved mother that was named Birgie Desmond. She was the daughter of Lula Nallen Desmond, my mother. My mother, the interesting thing, I'm the last of 13 children, so my mother, if she were living today, would be in her, she'd be 100 and some, maybe close to 120 years old. So my grandmother, being coming from that background, I'm really connected. Now, during the course of my life, I've had a lot of trials and tribulations, and I've had family therapy, and one of the things I wanted to know was, well, actually, what drove me into interest in therapy and psychology was to understand my mother. And in order to understand her, I had to understand that she was a child of Appomattox. And the most searing memory of my grandmother was telling us the thing that was most frightening of that day in April when slavery ended. She said they were crying and confused, and they kept telling the slave master, they called him the captain, so they kept telling them, you're free, you're free. And they didn't know what it was. They were hungry. She said the Union soldiers was running up and down the road. They were breaking in. They were killing animals. They were eating molasses. See, it was months before the Freedom Bill arrived. So that kind of trauma informed my psyche. And my mother, my grandmother, we call her Granny abandoned her daughters and left her daughters my grandfather. And so I had to understand why my mother had an emotional abandoning issue, that she would take two of her children, favor them, and the other one she would ostracize. So it drove me deep into studying the psychology of slavery. And I was able, through that kind of understanding, to forgive my mother and appreciate her more. And that's why around 9 or 10 years old, I started reading psychology books. I want to understand my mother. I want to understand why me being her favorite boy and the youngest boy, and we know in African-American culture, the baby boy usually gets a pass. But my mother turned against me with all her fury, and I know one of my nieces is probably listening. I hate to say this, but she knows that she's a social worker. My mother even tried to kill me. So rather than hating my mother, I had to understand her. And more, it drove me not to have rage at her. It drove me to have rage at slavery and to understand what slavery has done. So it's been a very real institution for me.
Well, I'll tell you something. I think, unfortunately, there are probably a lot of young people who are out there who can relate to some of the things that you went through with your mother, but still staying on the topic of young people. You know, you're talking about slavery. Is slavery still relevant? Young people, I think, are so absorbed in the culture. How can you talk about something that they're being told is no longer relevant and we should have gotten over? So, I mean, I don't think it's, I think it's still relevant. But how do we?
I tell my children that every day, and they say that to me. That I have grown children. I always explain these things, but they find it difficult. But as I show them the patterns, I said, you know, one of the things I said I've been fortunate to study was African history prior to us coming here. And when I contrast that with what we went through on those 300 years of slavery, and segregation was not a light institution as well. I remember that. I remember segregated bathrooms, going to the hospital, black wards. I mean, African-Americans couldn't even be on the same. I remember my physician, the guy who delivered me, couldn't even come to my hospital and treat me as a patient. He could only come as a visitor. So this is no more than 50 years ago. This is not very long. So I think we're the only people. I've studied the Irish. I've studied the Scots, and we know Scotland is seeking independence. No people were going anyplace have got forgotten their collective memory. I live with the American Indians. I don't pretend to say I understand American Indians, but I had a lot of contact with them, went to school with them. And they still believe that they're going to be victorious. And they refuse to forget or to forget what has happened to them. So I think we have to be the same.
Well, let me ask something. The young people that you hope that the show is going to reach, how do you effectively get them to reconnect with this past?
I think we're getting an echo, but we can probably deal with it. I think we have to just continuously connect what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri, what's going on with Michael Brown, and make the connection. One of the key components of Imam Muhammad's interpretation of life and events in religion was that he always told us to make connections. And I think we have had a difficult time making connections. What is the effects and what are the causes? So the conditions of African-American men abandoning their women, that didn't just come about. That happened for a reason. So I think it's difficult for us to understand, but you can't deal with the present without dealing with the past.
Imam Alfred?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm trying to deal with that echo. I'm sorry.
It's better now. Yes.
Just a second. Do me a favor and just give the audience a little bit of history on how you became a Muslim and how this heritage of coming from grandparents that actually were able to talk to you about the history of slavery, how that segued into you becoming a Muslim and accepting the Islamic faith.
Oh, that's a very good question. I'd love to answer it. My good Christian friends and pastors have often asked me that question. I had a very, let me say this too, and all fairness to my mother. My mother was a deeply spiritual person, a very God-fearing person. On the other hand, I had a very rational father who was very, very extraordinarily race-minded. He went to church, but he placed less emphasis on church language as my mother did. My mother was always praying. She would pray, and you could see tears running out of her eyes. So me, in the first 7 years of my life, my mother would always take me to church and take me to the seminary. Now, my mother was an extraordinarily shy lady. So I was exposed at about 7 years old, about 5 years old, to Bible teachers that my mother had made sure that I attended. But I also met some of the great people like Vernon John, Dr. Benjamin Mays. So I was ensconced very much in the intellectual side of African-American religion, but I believe the Christian doctrine, the birth, life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, literally. Only when I started interacting with African-American Christian preachers that some doubt came in my mind. And so one day I was at home, and I decided not to go to church that day, and some Muslim knocked on my door, and they said that I wanted to attend the temple. I was always sort of a searcher and seeker. I'd gone to all kinds of churches, to the Catholic Church, to the Holiness Church. I was a seeker. Even though I was a staunch, hard rock Baptist, believed it, hook, line, and sinker, I still had an open mind. But when I heard this temple of Islam meeting, and something particularly got to me when I read the Muhammad Speak newspaper, where he said Christianity should be thrown in the garbage can, and the garbage can in turn should be used to fight like hell with the white man. And that just shook me. Then another part of the paper that Muhammad speaks and said, let the dead bury the dead. And I have been a person who really at this time in my life had been very turned off to African-American funerals. Now, I'm sort of the opposite. I'll explain that later. But I began to see really sadness in our funerals, and the Muslim funeral appealed to me. So I joined the Nation of Islam. But that was Lynchburg was a small town, small temple. There wasn't very active. There was a lot of factionalism going on in the temple there. So I stayed about 6 months, and just lo and behold, the civil rights movement rose, and I'm now active in the civil rights movement. And really, it was in the civil rights movement that I got an opportunity to really get my stride in preaching or being a public speaker. I mean, the civil rights movement was a very, very strong movement. And I would say, unlike the church, if you had talent, you could really grow. The church, if you didn't look the right way, you didn't come from the right family, I don't care whether you were called a preacher or not, and you were in one of these small towns, you were not going to give it the opportunity. But I said the people that were under Dr. King, people like Virgil Woodruff, C.T. Vivian, Rod Walker, he was a pastor in Petersburg, they gave us opportunities. That's why I got a chance to really start preaching. Well, I'm now torn between Ahmadinejad Muhammad and Dr. King. And that took me on maybe almost an eight-year topsy-turvy battle in my own soul. And it was in 1968 that I came to New York. Actually, I came to New York to organize, do community organizing. And I was living on 115th Street. And between, you know, trying to organize the people to pick up garbage in the neighborhoods and everything, I went to Books and Things, and there was a man by the name of Larry Foex, another man by the name of Dr. Leo. And they asked me, brother, do you know about the messengers program? So I assiduously avoided a discussion. Said, well, everybody knows about it, right? They said, but do you know about it? And I said, well, you know, I know the messengers program is right and exact. It's a rhetorical flourish. I really didn't want to engage in it. Because I must tell you at this time, I really didn't buy the Nation of Islam as an intellectual project, even though I bought it as a great thing for other people, not for me. So that was my turn. But it was Minister Larry Foex, who now known as Akbar Muhammad, Minister Akbar Muhammad, started engaging me in discussion and kind of made me question. At this point, I'm now pretty much an agnostic. I'm not really into religion at all. I'm pretty much turned off to the Nation of Islam. I know more as an intellectual project, and I thought that it was a project was good for people, but certainly wasn't good for me. I thought I was an intellectual. I suppressed being a preacher. I wasn't interested. I was turned completely off to the church at this point.
Let me ask you, what was the final hook?
Minister Larry Foex, now known as Akbar Muhammad, said, Brother Alfred, why don't you come in the nation and help change the nation? And I went over all the points by points of my objections. And he refuted every one of them. And it was in September of 1969. I was teaching school in Utica, New York. I returned to the temple and was reinstated in Buffalo, New York, and Temple Number 23 in Buffalo. And the rest is kind of history, except for, you know, I was kind of on a sabbatical for a few years of research or that my own thing. Yeah.
Well, you said that you first were exposed in Lynchburg, Virginia. Interesting, I just heard a story about a temple that arose in Virginia as a result of an entire church.
Yes, you're speaking of Brother David. And this really was because of a brother by the name of Brother Minister Benjamin, who had been converted to the Nation of Islam by the Ahmadinejad Muhammad personally. He went to preach and speak, or teach, we wouldn't call it preaching, teach in Minister David's church, and the entire church converted.
Yes. I was fascinated by that story, and I never heard that story before. But let's fast forward a little bit, those who call in think that we are here to talk about only the Nation of Islam as it was back in 1960 or 1969. Tell me a little bit about how you transitioned when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who most people know as somebody that taught, somebody most people think of as somebody that taught that whites were devils and he wanted to advocate for a separate state for African Americans since whites did not want African Americans assimilating. And then his son, who was the designated leader, chosen, selected before the Honorable Elijah Muhammad passed, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad apparently endorsed this selection up until the very end of his life. Tell us a little bit about how that transition impacted on you.
Oh, I'm happy to tell you. Well, there were some things that precedes that transition. I met a man one day selling papers named Brother Benjamin, and he told me, "Brother, stay away from me because I'm a hypocrite." And I said, "Brother, you couldn't be a hypocrite because you're a good brother." And he turned out later on to tell me that he was Malcolm's assistant. He was the one to introduce Minister Malcolm to the day that he passed. He lived right on 39 Edgecombe. I lived at 883 St. Nicholas. So he used to buy the paper from me, and he said, "Brother, you should really talk to Minister Wallace." And he gave me Minister Wallace's telephone number. Well, I didn't pay much attention because I still was active in the nation. Well, there was one day in July, I don't know what year it was. Not good on years, but I know it's in the 70s. And Minister Wallace D. Muhammad was teaching at the temple at 5335 South Greenwood Avenue. And I would later on recall that event, Billy Man Muhammad. He said, "Oh, you were watching me back then." He came into the temple with an FOI uniform, which was really too small for him. He had a screen tie on. He had messaged to the black man in the palm of his hand, and he was about an hour late. So all of that was totally incongruent with what a Nation of Islam minister was supposed to have done. So, I was fascinated by him. Well, I was under Minister Parker, and I must tell you, Minister Parker was a spellbinder, and I had developed a relationship with him. And I really thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread, maybe since bean pie, probably greater than bean pie. And when I heard Minister Wallace D. Muhammad speak, I use the term James Baldwin used, my dungeon shook. And so by these presaging events, now I'm going to be honest with you, I did not believe the Honorable Muhammad would die. I would go into a religion, I had to buy hook, line, and sinker. I bought it completely. I thought the Honorable Muhammad was going to live 400 years. I believed the white man was grafted on the Isle of Pino. I literally believed the teachers. Once I had suspended intellectual judgment, I bought all the way. I used the scripture of Old Baptist Church. I was fully baptized in it.
Well,
so when February 25th, 1975 took place, and they said the Honorable Muhammad had died, I said, "These devils are still lying again. Why do they keep doing this? They're the devil." So I didn't really believe that the Honorable Muhammad died. I went to Chicago believing that the Honorable Muhammad was living. And they had a film Tuesday, 1975, and I really thought that the Honorable Muhammad would bounce up on the stage and speak. Well, once Imam Muhammad had spoken, I was comforted, and it was sort of an easy process from then on, because I had been prepared by Brother Benjamin, Minister Benjamin, Brother Benjamin Tuek later on became Minister Imam Benjamin Kareem. So I really would say, outside of the Honorable Muhammad, the only minister of the Nation of Islam that really impressed me was Minister Wallace D. I must tell you, and I don't mean any disrespect to him. I love the Minister Alari Poet, Akbar Muhammad. I heard most of the Honorable Muhammad's ministers, and sort of the nation had a very interesting way of dealing with people. If you were bright-eyed and you were aggressive, they would favor you. And I used to visit Chicago quite often, so I got to know all of the officials, Elijah Muhammad, Abbas Rasool, just all of them. And they were open to they were very open to me. So I got an opportunity to listen to all the Abdullah Muhammad's ministers. And I must say, outside of Imam Muhammad, I wasn't impressed with most of them.
Mm-hmm. When you joined the Nation of Islam, it sounds to me like it, there was a social reason. Not, I don't know if you felt that it was more for religious clarity.
Well,
or
I had
it,
to. Being the kind of person I am, I'm very religious by nature, I would have to buy the doctrine. I had to buy it. So, but what I did do was suspend the intellectual judgment. It didn't satisfy my intellect. And I was sort of turned off privately to the condemnation of Dr. King and the African American, other African American leaders, but I suspended it. And I would again say I give great credit to Minister Larry Fouad, to Akbar Muhammad. Him and I think Dr. Shabazz and another minister by the name of Kamal Majid. Kamal Majid was one of the people that actually was responsible for inventing the kidney dialysis machine. These were intellectuals inside the community. They have guided me, and they could justify almost any of the Nation of Islam teachers. You know, Dr. Shabazz was a mathematician, so when I wanted to understand Yaqub's history and grasping the genetics, they could explain, oh, well, this is Mendel's law, blah, blah, blah. So I had a lot of justification for the Nation of Islam teaching. I joined it because I thought it was a complete package. And in a way now, when I look at it, I see it still as a complete package, but wrapped up in a package that has to be unwrapped.
Well, let me ask you, if since the since Imam Waraseddin Muhammad presented a different message, how were you able to deconstruct what you liked about the Nation and then, you know, value what this young minister was offering?
Well, one of the things I like about Imam Muhammad, he demythologized the Nation. Wow. Well, I want to go back to the first time I heard him when he was a minister. He never used one word of the Bible. He stayed in the Quran. And he still talked about improving African-American people's lives. I remember these words exactly. He said, you know, brothers and sisters, I was late driving down Lakeshore Drive, and I looked at on the beach, and there was a Negro, so-called Negro, sitting on the beach, and the white man was riding in the yacht. He said, there's something wrong with that picture. And he said, that's what Abdullah Muhammad is here to change. So he was always using the Abdullah Muhammad as a liberator. And I was easily able to just transition. I thought the transition was very smooth. In fact, when he started mentioning Dr. King and other African-American people, my soul was just eased step by step because I didn't want to throw those people away. The Nation kind of forced me to throw those people away. We didn't put much emphasis on African-American history. We were told that all were thieves and robbers besides Mr. Mm-hmm. Barak. So the Imam made the transition very easy, and over a period of maybe 10 years, I became very comfortable with myself. And I must tell the audience, I later found out that Imam Muhammad had detected already. I didn't go around telling people I'd been a Baptist preacher because that was something in the Nation. People had a real bad opinion of preachers. But a brother by the name of John Ramadan, he's gone on to his death reward, and may God give him the highest state in paradise. He said, brother, can I ask you a question? He said, because Imam Muhammad and I were talking about you one night. I said, what question is that? He said, were you a childhood preacher? I said, why you ask that? I didn't really want to disclose it. I kind of kept it very private. He said, Imam said, he said, I don't bet, but I can guarantee he was a childhood preacher. And in 1978, I met Imam Muhammad, and I wrote him a note and said, Brother Imam, I've seen you, Imam. I read in a minister's kit where he said if a brother wanted to be a leader, being a minister under him, and he came to him, whatever problems he might have had, he would work with the brother. So I wrote him and said, I'm from New York, and I believe I could help you. I believe I could be one of your best. So Imam Muhammad says, the brother here now? I said, yes, sir. So he said, see me over at the mosque at the masjid at 10 o'clock. At 10 o'clock the next day, he appointed me to be his assistant. And the rest is kind of history. But I must tell you that, interestingly enough, in my own private discussion with Imam Muhammad detected clearly the one I had with had been heavily influenced by religion. Two, I've been heavily employed by Marxist Leninist ideas. And one day I thought he was going to tell me what he wanted me to teach. He came, asked me to come upstairs to talk with him. And he asked me, did I know the difference between blood and water in the Bible? And, of course, I gave him some ideas. And he said, yeah, no, but not quite clear. And he started teaching me for about an hour and a half on water and blood in the scripture. And once I told him blood, I thought blood. He said, why do you think the communists use the term blood? I said, I don't know. I said, think that because of passion. He said, no, because it's a social connection. So I would say Imam Muhammad was just, and he told me later, he said, maybe 3 months later, he said, you know, I recognize that you, he said, the leader should have brought you to me a long time ago. He said, I recognize that you had a religious gift. And he never told me that he thought he knew I had been a preacher before. But he had detected that he was a very excellent reader. And I'm convinced that Allah guided him, and I'm convinced that any of us who get into this work, we would never not get the station that he got. But Allah will give you intuition, and it's part of our Christ nature. And I tell you, I had this happen to me just recently at the convention. I was turning to shake people's hands, and I saw this young lady, and I said to her, you're a physician, aren't you? And she said to me, well, yeah, but how did you know? I said, well, I saw the stethoscope and the ophthalmoscope right on you. And I said, and I think that if we read people, and Imam was the best reader I have ever met of people, and I've been around some of the greatest African-American religious leaders, not only African-American religious leaders, some of the great religious leaders of our time, and he was exceptional in reading people.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Imam Muhammad, that his work was primarily to bring people a spiritual message?
No. He hated that term. It's the enemies of Imam Muhammad that first coined him a spiritual leader. You want a spiritual leader, go to the one fortune tellers. They spiritual. He saw himself as a total leader. He also really endeared me to him is that he was very interested in the cause of establishing us as a people. And that's what I had missed. Even in the Nation of Islam, I know that the leaders of the Nation of Islam were not interested in our people unless they were interested in converting our people. And through private conversations and studying Imam Muhammad, I just found a man that was in love with our people. And the first conversations I had was around March of 1978. We were talking about African-American leaders, and I said, well, Imam, you know, I love Dr. Mays. He said, oh, you love Dr. Mays, too? Imam, as probably some of you know, was not a very animated person. I had brought up some of the other leaders, and he just looked at me in disgust. And basically, you know, sometimes Imam Muhammad, if you brought up certain people, he would could be of the opinion that you were connected to them. Imam Muhammad was very careful about people who would be sent to the communities. I had mentioned some of the other leaders. So when I told him that I liked Dr. Benjamin Mays, he said, man, I like Dr. Mays, too. He said, I used to read him all the time in the Pittsburgh Courier. So we bonded Dr. Mays was the man that was most bonding to us. Another person.
Imam Alfred, would you just share with the audience who Dr. Benjamin Mays was?
Yes, ma'am. And I will say to the audience, I hope some enterprising young person would help us archive these tapes. The author of the biography, I would think the definitive biography of Dr. Mays, is a man by the name of Professor Jelks. And Professor Jelks has written a biography of Dr. Mays called Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays, the Schoolmaster of the Movement. Dr. Mays was originally from South Carolina, went to the University of Chicago, had a bachelor's degree from Bates College, and then got a master's at the University of Chicago, and wrote his master's thesis on the pagan origins of Christianity in 1932. He later became the founding dean of Howard University School of Religion, And one of his five students was a man by the name of Dr. Howard K. Thurman, to me the second most important theologian in America and the foremost among our people outside of Imam Muhammad. Dr. David Leon became the president of Morehouse College and was a person that encouraged Dr. Martin Luther King to be a minister. Dr. King didn't want to be a minister. And Dr. Mays, to me, was the greatest educator African Americans have ever had. And after he led the position as the president of Morehouse College, stepped down and became the chairman of the school board in Atlanta. And Imam Muhammad brought Dr. Mays to Chicago to the Clare Muhammad School banquet. And Dr. Mays told Imam Muhammad, Imam Muhammad, I want you to know I'm a Hard Rock Baptist. And Imam Muhammad told him, said, Dr. Mays, I'm a Hard Rock Muslim, and kissed him on the head and said, I love you too. And Imam Muhammad went to Dr. Mays' funeral. So he loved Dr. Mays. And I would say to our audience, I don't think if we were to have prophets, we don't have prophets, the last one was Muhammad, but if we were looking at prophetic figures, Dr. Mays was certain to be one of the seven most important people in our making. And the law says, within you and you in the heavens and also within you is seven. And I think that one of the seven major figures in African-American metaphysics would be Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays.
Well, one of the things that I think is important here is that we keep this connection. And I know that Imam Muhammad was, I think the library at Morehouse, is it? Has
yes,
a,
ma'am.
A portrait of him. And I think it's very important for African-American Muslims and Christians to keep this connection and this mutual appreciation and respect, especially in light of the climate in the world. Let's talk more about what's going on in the world right now. I know that you have strong ideas about addressing some of the issues in our community. And I'm sure Dr. Mays, if he were living, he would be very outspoken. I think I called him a founder of Morehouse. I'm glad you cleared that up in my intro. But in any case, we have so many leaders that work very diligently so that we could be free and that we could expect to have the right to vote and that we could expect justice. And now we see that our community is suffering from a lot of internal strife and suffering. So what are some of your thoughts about what is going on currently in the African American community?
I think we are going through just a short period of this is truly Logan called the period between Reconstruction and slavery, the nadir. I don't think that was a nadir. I think that was one of the golden ages of progress for us. I think this is just a little dark period. I think we are celebrating from 1965 to current. I think we are getting ready to enter in 2015, a new era. I want to say something about Dr. Mays and Islam and connect this to the world situation and where we are and then get back to ours. Little hiccup. I just think we're having a hiccup. You know, baby, you're a nurse, so you know babies sometimes have a hiccup. And you know, parents may get very disturbed, but pediatricians tell you it's not something to be totally concerned about. I address it, and I try to address it as a physician, and I use therapeutic techniques of intervention, but I'm not really disturbed by this little hiccup we're experiencing. I want to say this about Dr. Mays. Dr. Mays had written a book, and in that book, his autobiography, he discusses his encounter with Islam. He never tells us what he thought of Islam, but he said this Muslim had challenged him to be why he was a Christian. Now, I want to even more explicitly talk about Dr. Howard K. Thurman in a book called Along the Way. The reason I'm not quoting Dr. Mays is because I can't recall. So we'll tolerate the disturbance that we set up. Okay.
Email Alfred?
Yes, ma'am. Now, I can.
go ahead and tell us about Dr. Mays.
Okay, Dr. Mays had made not an illusion, actually a sentence talking about the storm. He didn't say his opinion, but he told the people that he had encountered on a train ride in Egypt with a Muslim. And this Muslim had asked him, why was he a Muslim? Why was he a Christian? I think Dr. Mays laid that on the pages of history. And Imam Muhammad said when he met Dr. Mays, he could see relief on his face when he became, when he, to know that Imam Muhammad didn't have to go through the crisis that he had gone through. And I think African-American Christian leaders had to go through the crisis. I want to also share with you another, before, because I'm going to answer your question, but I'm giving background. When I told Dr. Samuel DeWitt Proctor, the former pastor of the Abbotsford Church, I said, Dr. Proctor, I have decided that this is during the kind of transition that I'm becoming an imam. What can you tell me? And I looked at Dr. Proctor's face, and he looked pained. Then I saw a picture of relief. And he said to me, well, you know, you have to be prepared. There's not much I can tell you. Just be prepared. And I think, and Howard Thurman said something that let me know that they both wanted to put his palm on the pages. And Dr. Thurman, said that he was in India in 1931 at the YMCA conference. He was in Indonesia, no, not in India, but actually was taking a ride through the Kaaba path and going from India to what is now known as Afghanistan. And Mahatma Gandhi asked him the question, said, Thurman, why don't you become a Muslim? Now, this is an Hindu. He said, because if you become a Muslim, you instantly eliminate racism. Not racism, you become a brother of all the Muslims. Thurman didn't raise that, they never answered that question. I think he put it on the pages of history to say that those men, those three men, those two men in particular, and Dr. Proctor never gave me any indication what he thought, but he certainly didn't condemn me. He never said, well, I don't think you should be a Muslim. He just said, be prepared. I think the, and I'm going to answer that by saying, at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, which is the first church that Dr. King pastored, there's a portrait in the church of a picture painted by a Morehouse student. And in that picture is a picture of the Imam W.D. Muhammad at the top and Dr. King making dua praying for Imam Muhammad. What I'm saying is Dr. Thurman, Dr. Mays, and particularly, and there are probably others, but I know there are these two men, put enough hints in our material to let us know that they wanted us to take a look outside of Christian. Also, Dr. King, I don't know why I forgot to mention Dr. King. In the last chapter of his last book, this is very prophetic, he said the Christian, Muslim, Hindu concept of God is love. Now, this is Dr. Martin Luther King in a chapter called The World House. And I say this in light of the fact that we have some housework, house cleaning we have to do, or some housework, household work we have to do. But we never can forget the fact that we are a prophetic people. And that's why I support Mosque Cares. And there's a prayer breakfast being held at Union Seminary on Thursday. And they didn't call the president of Mosque Cares Wallace Muhammad. They called him Imam Wazdeen Muhammad II. So why is it that outsiders, Christians, Jews, Hindus, and others can recognize the president of Mosque Cares as our leader? The Saudis can recognize him. The Islam can recognize him as Imam. Even the African-American congressman, Andrew Carson, I was in a program that I was invited by Imam, in my opinion, and I called him my Imam, Imam Wazdeen II. And Congressman Andrew Carson called him Imam Wazdeen Jr. So I think with the community may be adjusting, they're still adjusting to the Abdullah Muhammad's passing. We haven't even gotten over the Abdullah Muhammad's passing. And Imam Muhammad's sudden death, I think we're still going through some changes. But I want to say to the community, I am not hopeless at all. I believe in the next 3 to 4 years, you're going to see something that the Abdullah Muhammad predicted and Imam Muhammad predicted. Both of them predict that the community would go away from the public. The Abdullah Muhammad said the community would go down to nothing. But he said when it come back, it would be the greatest thing moving on the earth and nothing would stop it. Imam Muhammad said when the community come back, he said this is 1975, March to be exact. He said, and they're going to say the Nation of Islam has gone away. And people said, whatever happened to the Nation of Islam? He said, but when it comes back, it will be educational power. It will be an economic power. It will be a cultural power. It will be a political power. And I believe we're just on the eve of that great day. It's a dreadful day for the evil, wicked people who are in a minority. But for the good, sincere believers of all ethnic groups, despite all the little hiccups we're having with the violence in our neighborhoods and the lack of productivity in our neighborhoods and all the little symptoms of not, us not understanding what we have been blessed with, but I think that our people wake up, they will be the same way that little boy Alfred Booker woke up and saw this great religion and got enthused by it and got infused with truth and decided that he's going to do everything in his living being to serve the people of God, in my opinion. The people that God has chosen to be the foremost people on this earth is the African-American. I told a group of Caucasians just a few hours ago, I said, you know, I'm talking about our prophetic mission. I said, if I were, they told me, the angel told me I could come back, I could die and I could come back as Bill Gates and Warren Buffett combined. I would say I'm sending you back among the Negroes, and I'm sure and 5, I told them 5 to 10 years, they looked at me like I was crazy. You'll see one of the greatest people on earth. Mm-hmm. I believe that with all my heart, all my mind, and all my spirit.
I'm wondering if, you know, some people listening in might interpret that to mean that African-Americans, some African-Americans are seeing themselves still as a superior, you know. I mean, I just want you to clarify.
I certainly do. What I believe that the 400 years of suffering has been an emptying process, that everything was basically emptied out of us. We were no longer wallops. Became as Fulu, became as Yoruba. God, through his magnificent processes, allowed us to be empty. And we were first slaves of Caucasians. And I'm not saying all the slave masters were devils, but most of them were, because they were wise people. Certainly the overseers weren't. They were used to. But this emptying process created in us a vacuum where we only one we could serve is God. And I think deep, just right under the surface of most of African-American people, we could never tolerate any form of black supremacy, and I'm going to give you a proof of this. There's a very phenomenal attorney that chairs the Adway with us. He's also has been a law professor. He was a legislator and city council in Selma, Alabama. He told Taylor Branch, the author of the Clinton Diaries and the author of Parting the Wars and 3 other volumes of Dr. King, he said, the reason I could not join the Nation of Islam is because of the fact that my sister's life, Ruby, was saved by a man by the name of Jim Reed, a Caucasian man, pulled a gun and said, nigga, get out of here, and shot at her. And this Caucasian took the bullet.
Mm.
We could never be white black supremacists when we think about Viola LaRusa. We can never be black supremacists when we think about John Brown, Cheney and Goodman, Swana rather, and Goodman, we don't use Cheney with African American. Those people who have given their lives to see us and others free. So I see this positioning as a position to be a servant, not to be superior. But I believe that God has made us to be the people of Joseph, to serve him and him alone. And I'm reminded of a great African American spiritual that said, I promised the Lord that I
would serve him until I die. Number one, they said before I would be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go back to my Lord and be free. I think our people want to be slaves only to God. And I know that's a tough term to use, and we shouldn't even use that term often. I apologize for the slave of God because that's such an ugly term. But let's say the servant of God. And how can you serve God? Only by serving his most precious creation, the human being. And secondly, by serving, taking care of the earth. I want everybody to know this is climate change week. We're going to be treated to an address by the former Vice President of the United States, Vice President Al Gore. And this is one of his, this is his passion. And I'm happy to say that our leader of Mosque Cares, those who support Mosque Cares, should be proud that Imam Wahdi Muhammad has been asked to give an address to this very important climate change issue. So I believe we have been raised up to serve humanity, not to serve ourselves. And one of the things that made me feel so good about Imam Muhammad was that he expanded my humanity. Now, it didn't mean that I would go out and escape my own responsibilities, but it meant that I could serve a broader scope of humanity. In fact, I'm planning a book right now. I've been working on a book called African Americans, Out of Islam, the African American, and the Destiny of Man. And part of this interview will be put in that book because I want us to know what is our prophetic role in the world. And I think we have a prophetic role in the world to make the world a better place and to make sure that slavery is not suffered by anybody. I don't care whether it's a sex slave, a labor slave. We want to break all forms of slavery.
Well, thank you, Jim Alfred. And I want to ask, if you want to call in, you can call in at 805-727-7013. Please call in if you have any questions for Imam Alfred Muhammad. And just to give you the heads up, that Imam Alfred Muhammad does accept donations to support the Religion Means Alive radio show at 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, of 07036. Please call in. We want to ask you some other questions, Imam Alfred. And I want to tell you that when I first met Imam Alfred Muhammad, quite a few people told me, stay away from him. He's a very unusual person. And I tell you, the more I talk to you, the more I realize he's too compelling to stay away from. Let's figure out why he's so unusual. So why don't you tell me why you think, some people think that Imam Alfred is a little eccentric or a little unusual. I've gotten to know you well enough to know that you're comfortable talking about this kind of thing. So tell me what you think.
Yes, I think that it, well, I must tell you, and this is not some braggadocious thing. I was talking to a man who said, you know, when I was growing up, I was classified as a genius. And I said, you know, being a genius is not what it cracks up to be. I said, I was also classified as that as sort of a savant. It was a burden on me, and really for a long time, a tremendous burden. And then I kind of realized that God had called me to something to serve. I could do certain things. I must tell you, first of all, I never really wanted to be a preacher. That's one I didn't want. But he kept coming back at me. I mean, it's like the reluctant prophetic urge in it of Jonah. Well, a brother was asked, Imam Muhammad, one day, and this imam, he remained anonymous. He said I know who you are. He said, I was with Imam Muhammad one day that you called Imam's house. And he said, I asked Imam Muhammad, who is it keep calling you? And he said, Imam didn't answer the phone. And Imam said, name me. He said, and the brother said, Imam said, oh, do you know him? He said, and the brother said, he fought. He said, Imam Muhammad said, no, you don't know him. He said, because if you met him one time, you'll never forget him. So I think I'm a person that took me a while to be comfortable with myself, and having been around some of the great leaders, at some points I didn't think of other people's reaction to me. And I think also I was heavily influenced by the early, what they call the secular preachers. Those who are scholarly may want to read a book by a man by the name of Harvey Parker called The Secular City.
and it was advocating that preachers take off their robes and just be regular persons. Sometimes I think I became too regular. And as a result of that fact, people misread me. Secondly, I think the second thing that people misread have called me, I've written in a thesis, up in a thesis called Enigma. It's not difficult for people to figure me out. They think I'm an antagonistic person. But I am strategic. I will say this also. I have been pretty harsh on our leaders, but never tried to be personally harsh on them. All of them I'm very close to personally. But there's one that's, I won't talk about, I won't name him. He's big in national circles outside of our community. And I recently had to, had some medical needs, and he called me, how soon can you get over to see me? And I said, well, probably in a couple of hours. He said, I got $300 for you. And he pointed out, but this guy, this imam, and I have been knowing each other for many years. He came up in the Nation of Islam with me. One thing I've never done is broken my friendships. Very few I've broken friendship with. My Baptist preacher's friends, I still keep those friendships. So people find me strange. On the one hand, I will have heated ideological arguments with them about ideas and concepts. And next thing you see me in IHOP, well, I'm going to IHOP anymore, but I mean, I guess I could cheat once out of 30 days the next time you see me in IHOP. I'm trying to follow a strict diet.
I've often thought that we've kind of lost the tradition of being able to debate issues without making it a personal character issue. But I also think that it's interesting to have someone that is so much grasp of history, but has also had experiences at extremes. You know, you've had ups and downs, personal life, and I don't know how much of that you've talked about on the air, but I've always found it very inspiring that you're very open about some of your personal struggles, and you've always said that you like to kind of let people know that, you know, this human experience is something that we all go through, and that the work and the mission of helping human beings and helping African Americans, all people, is really what it is about. And I always say that I think even Oprah Winfrey, her story is so interesting. I always think that the reason God has raised her up is to be evidence of that same idea, that no matter what life, you know, throws at you, so to speak, you are not defined by those things. We can constantly reinvent ourselves and repent, recreate ourselves, and readjust. So what are your thoughts about that for people out there who may have gone through things in life and maybe they're carrying a lot of shame, or maybe they think, well, I've made mistakes, so I'm not, you know, I shouldn't be reaching for certain dreams. That's beyond me. What ideas do you have about
that?
Well, I
thank you for asking that question. It gives me an opening. First of all, we tell people, saint I ain't. I'm an ain't, not a saint. But yet I love saints. If those are saints, fine. You know, my good Pentecostal friends, I see them, I call them saints. And I tell them, well, saint, I'm an ain't. And I do that to humanize myself. But I also want to say this. One of the things that impressed me the most about Imam Muhammad was his forgiving, merciful nature. And he came into office saying, I don't care if you drank liquor by the barrels. This is before I even knew you could smoke cocaine by the pound, whore hop every hour of the day, just as the Arabian prophet was called, just as Jonah was called, you too have been called for a mission. And that always touched me. And I was also touched by one of Dr. King's sermons called Keeping the Bread Fresh. And people said Dr. King was preaching to himself. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, just because you have a fault. You know, I've been married, I've been homeless. My first wife had a mental illness, God bless her. I have 7 children. I've had struggles with them. They've had struggles with me. I haven't been the perfect father. I haven't been the perfect husband. I say to women who would even be married to me or would be married to me, you know, I'm not an easy person. I'm not an easy case. My first wife, and that's, I have to say this, and this is, women don't like me saying this,
It's my love of my work. And it's a work I've been thrusted into that I, if I had to, you know, it's like a bitter cup. If I had to make a choice, I would have been a physician. I would have been on my way home now from making rounds. That was my fantasy and dream world, to have been a physician. That's what I loved. So I said, maybe God wants me to make physician, not be a physician. I had to accept that. So I've had my struggles. I've had struggles. But along the way, I've never given up. And I tell anybody in the audience, I don't care what you're struggling with, don't ever give up. It's not over until the chapter is closed.
I think that's an important message for these times. And I think that, you know, there are probably young people out there that are self-medicating because of the shame that they feel. A lot of our young people have fallen into lifestyle that is, you know, very painful, or they've inflicted pain on other people. And then the drugs or the self-medicating ensues because we don't know how to handle our shame. And I think it's important that we have leaders among us that can really speak to that from a place of authenticity. So, you know, I thank you.
I'm going to share something with the audience that I've never really shared with. I've shared it only with a circle of friends. And I think it's now time to share this. Our people, again, I reiterate, and this is no excuse. I am the grandson of a slave. The most horrific treatment known to human beings, slavery in America. One man said if he had to go back and slave, I was reading an account and lay my burdens down, the oils for slavery, he said, I would blow my brains out. He would kill himself. So think of coming from that. Then think of all what we had gone through. I mean, you know, I've had perhaps three attempts on my life by Caucasians. You know, I won't say devils, but no more than 20 years ago, I was walking through a bunk one day, and between my gun and the bunk, the guy put a gun to my head and said, nigga, where you going? And I said, I'm lost. And he said, keep walking. And, you know. But, I mean, I've gone through those kinds of experiences, and I'm not letting those experiences shape me. But what I will say to our audience, and advocate strongly, and I remember Imam Muhammad advocating that when I was in a very difficult time. He said, you know, we really have to study the effects of slavery. And he said, you know what? We need to engage, receive psychotherapy. So I feel I have, it's not a luxury for us. You need a person that can sit and listen to you for 45 minutes. They're going to charge you, of course. And I don't think you can have therapy if you don't pay for it. I really don't think it means anything. If my position is if you don't pay $10 for it, it's not worth it. You don't pay the price of a movie, it's not worth it. You know, I have to recognize the fact that I was also sharing with our audience today that an African-American psychoanalyst told me one time. He said, Mr. Muhammad, you're not a Christian. I said, not right. He said, but you are into suffering. And I think we who come from that background of 400 years of suffering, we will bring suffering in our lives subconsciously without even knowing it. We'll pick up friends. We'll pick up people. We'll pick up things that's going to cause us to suffer because the picture we have of religion is a suffering savior, and we rescue people that we shouldn't rescue, and we don't spend enough time being merciful to ourselves. So I have been predisposed to psychotherapy. I've been predisposed to family therapy, and I think that we need more of it. I think the missing link in this community is the psychotherapeutic process.
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, interestingly, you know, they talk about the fact that the violence that is sadly affecting so many of us in our neighborhoods is creating a group kind of post-traumatic stress disorder. And it kind of feeds into the violence. So people are suffering group mental illness, and it feeds into people being more afraid, and it feeds into people feeling that they need more firearms. And I think that the level of stress is so high in certain neighborhoods in our community that it's a huge, to me, it's a massive mental health crisis. And
Yes, ma'am.
I hear you talking about therapy, and I've thought about this so much I've thought about it so much because, you know, I see a lot in my own community. And I wonder, is there an approach? I mean, not everybody is going to be able to access the healthcare system. Not everybody is going to feel comfortable getting family therapy or private therapy. And some even young people may really want to have the therapy, but their parents are, you know, maybe strung out on drugs, or their parents are in a place where they're not going to access it for those young people. So, I want to ask you about, you know, how are we going to access the therapy that we need to get on with, you know, our human existence, but also I think Imam Muhammad's work, life's work, really tied into the answer to this question. So I'm asking you, but I also want to ask you this other side of it is, how do you perceive us getting Imam Muhammad's work out there so that we can really address this group therapy that's needed?
Yes, I'm going to first answer the first part of the question, which is really the question you raised about this violence, which is a reenactment. You know, in psychoanalysis, it's spoken of quite often, a reenactment, what is called a sort of a trance. So the person that witnessed the father beating the hell out of his mother, 9 chances of 10, or Ray Lewis is going to repeat that unless there's an intervention take place. The person learns to beat that child with a switch. Well, I was beat with a switch. Well, I don't do that to my children. But we have to have some intervention. A body at rest tends to stay at rest unless it's moved by a greater force. That's number one. That's just a law. Number two, I think that for those who can't get therapy, we need to develop in our messages, in our churches, in our neighborhood, the art of listening. We can learn a lot from our British friends about the art of listening, just to listen to. You know, the average one of us you talk to, as soon as you say, you know, I'm having a problem with myself, but this is what you should do, sister. This is what you should do. But what you really should do is just listen to the person. You know, a lady called me one time with a real big problem, and she said, are you still there? I said, yeah, I'm still here. I'm just listening. And she thanked me for this listening. I said, brother, I don't need to tell you. I don't want you to give me a suggestion, because the more I hear it, we should do a lot more of that. Just be an ear for each other. Not judgmental.
Yeah.
Not trying to make recommendations. And the reason why we all try to make recommendations is because it makes us feel uncomfortable. I have a friend of mine that called me very angry. So his anger bothers me. So my natural response, if I hadn't had any training, I would respond to it. Why don't you do this? Now, what really I'm saying, I'm bothered by your anger. But all I have to do it to myself is acknowledge that I'm angry. Now, second thing we need to do is we need to institute dance therapy right in there. If we put dance and music and culture in among us, where we can reenact, I think we need to have rituals that reenact slavery, rituals that reenact what happened to Emmett Till. I guarantee if you went to every neighborhood, reenacted what happened to Emmett Till, and showed people pictures of how Emmett Till looked after he was killed, I think those people in the South Side of Chicago would have an epiphany. You know, they realize that they're killing each other because all they're doing is reenacting what happened to Emmett Till. You know, I had a very interesting thing that happened to me in a restaurant. I was out in Chicago speaking to Ross Cares for the New World Patriotism Day, and so I decided, well, let me go out and see, can I get some people to come here and speak. But what is more important is that I met this man, and his name was Johnny Savior. And I said, Johnny, your name is Johnny Savior? He said, yes. I said, wow. I just jested, and I said, what day were you born? He said, I was born July 25th. So, you know, we African-Americans, we have this expression, you lie, man, you lie. He said, no, I was born July 25th. He said, not only was I born on July 25th, it was also the day that Emmett Till was born. And July 25th was the day that I was arrested and did 30 years in jail for 3 murders that I'd never committed, and he was saved by the Innocent Project. Well, Johnny Savior, you can look him up online, Johnny Savior came to the New World Patriotism Day, and he we haven't connected before. But the point I'm making is this. What happened to Emmett Till? What happened to Max Parker? What happened to the African-American woman that was dragged off on A&M campus, raped and never convicted? That's still in our soul. And unless we act it out, the people reenact it not in reality, but reenact it in plays and in rituals. The Jewish people, the Passover ritual is a ritual that holds them together. The Irish people have rituals. We have to have rituals. It has to be in culture. And those cultural processes will be therapeutic for us.
I have to interrupt you because, I find that to be a really radical idea. And I just wonder if there's anybody out there that would like to call in to tell us what they think about it. I mean, we're living in a time when our young people are obsessed with, entertainment. I just
know
if we can get them to come even to watch a reenactment of something that happened so long ago that they would prefer to forget.
What we have to do is go for the conscious people. I think that 80% of our people are under a deep sleep, if not, they're not dead. I would say they're in a deep sleep. And God tells us in the through the ritual called Adan, the call, it says, the Salat is better than sleep. So let's wake up the 20% of us. 20% of our people are not asleep. 20% of our people still hold to old-line values. And if we can get the help, yes, ma'am.
Ma'am, Alfred, that idea is so radical and so unique. I really am curious to hear if anyone out there has any response. Please give us a call if you'd like to call in to talk about what you think we need to do to address the mass group mental health issue in our communities that's leading to so much violence. You can call in at 805-727-7013. And I see we do have one caller on the line. Hold on. 917 caller, you're on the air.
How you doing today? This is Ismael Kadam from New York City.
I'm doing well, Ismael Kadam. How are you doing?
Historical interview. I don't want to take too much out of time to just go over that. But it's beautiful interview. But I
have to tell everybody. Close that Ismael Kadar is my son, and I'm delighted to have you call in. And are you going to give us some commentary on what you think about addressing this group of mental health issue?
Yes. I was trying to. It was such a good show that I just wanted to remain kind of silent and keep that. But this ritual thing had excited me because, and what I think. Personally, like the music and the people underestimate the importance and influence of the culture and the music and the money that's being made to advertise these young kids' more impressionable minds. And what you're saying, and to me, what you're kind of saying is that this issue of pain, this issue of even Tupac used to always talk about pain and having pain and the young people having pain, it doesn't originate in what they're doing, but it comes from that slave experience. And I think that is an important breakthrough because the ritual, most of us, even online, we talk about the hip-hop videos being rituals, being a ritual, which is like they're keeping a tradition of, a drug dealer, you got my money, I'm going to shoot you, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to destroy you. And it's like the commercial companies, they are not I would say that they are guilty. They're not innocent in the fact that they perpetuate that same stereotypical image and that same ritual. And I feel that, I think it was extreme in talking about Emmett Till, but I think the importance of the cultural piece and educational piece, in which we did a show a while about that, those two connections, is that if we try to, we at least do something, to talk about what has happened, I think it would have great significance, and that's what I think you're talking about as far as the young boys in Chicago, because at a time where hip-hop was a little bit more progressive. And it still, to me, it still needed room. I don't think that that's the imagery, just Public Enemy. And the 90s hip-hop seemed to be a little bit more, there was issues addressed in the culture. It wasn't such an extreme. There still were problems, but it wasn't such an extreme that I see it, that common, the way the common boy degrades, and woman degrades herself. And it seems that that has been growing.
Are you saying that we have rituals in the hip-hop culture that maybe we can attach some of the ideas that Imam Alford is talking about, that we can use music to attach some of these more healing rituals to?
Yes, man, that's what I'm saying. Because I saw an article about last year of a math professor, and he was using music. He was using music, and he was the class that he had, they passed significantly. And he related it. I don't know if the whole class was in music, but he related a lot of things to music. And I was just talking to my wife earlier about the fact that even with me leaving school, some things I was confused in going into school. I didn't see the significance of certain fields. And I think that what they have done in these videos, movies, entertainment, culture, also music is culture, but film is also part of culture too. If they'll make the drug dealer very important. And if you don't have any offshoot in our religion, what I love about our religion, it seems to be gives us something against the scheme of Satan. It makes us stand up. Okay, we don't like gambling, so then you have charity, you have zakat, you know, you have something to build a community. You don't like having sex outside marriage, then you have the importance of marriage. So there's always, I feel that we should highlight. And one of the things Tyler Perry tried to do is, I think he does it from a Christian. His interpretation of Christianity, and I think that grows. But I want to see the Muslim come in I'm sorry, but that's all I wanted to kind of say.
We're very short on time, Brother Kadar. But you tell me, can we go over 7:30, Imam Alford? Are we stuck?
Yes, you certainly can. We can go over. Yes.
Okay.
We're on
to
9 o'clock. As long as we go, we can go another half hour, I guess, if you wish, if there's any more persons that like to.
Okay, we do have a couple more callers. But go ahead, because what you're saying is really important, and I think I'm starting to really understand better what Imam Alford was talking about. As you clarify it, I understand. You're addressing, you know, even Tyler Perry is able to pull in the messages that he thinks need to be emphasized using the media. So Imam Alford is saying, hey, you know, we need to be more selective about what we remind our young people about. And I can see it
and
now.
And let me say this. It's time for the resurrection of the presidential movement. Imam Muhammad said, you want to change our people? He said, when the rappers decide to give us a different lyric, then our people will change. And I also want to remind our audience, too, of men like Dirty Grace. We were in a malaise back in the 20s, and Dirty Grace came up with that trumpets and the trombone and resurrection-style music. We need that kind of music now. Upbeat music, victorious music.
I understand.
Dances.
Thank you, Brother Kadar, for your wonderful comments. And I'm going to pick up a caller at area code 201. You are on the air.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Coro, Brother Imam Alford. I just want to congratulate you on this interview. It was excellent. I have a newfound respect for you, my brother Imam Alfred Muhammad. I thank Allah for this opportunity to just let you know that I have a high regard for who you are. And with regard to the idea of reenactment, Emmett Till and other experiences, Imam Muhammad asked us to create our theaters. We have to have theaters. And, you know, I see, it came to me just tonight listening to you, how significant it is to have theater. This is part of the group therapy. The Italians are very, very into opera. And the opera is a form of reenactment of things that they've experienced. We have to do what we have to do, and that will work as a part of the group therapy, I believe. So I thank you so much for your insight, and we have so much.
Thank you, and I will say this to you.
We have so much resources, so many resources.
Thank you, sister, and I also thank you, thank Allah so much for you. And I think, if I may say, what a wonderful and marvelous. See, a lot of us won't give credit to our church life. You were a great member of the great Convent Avenue Baptist Church. See, I give credit.
Oh, my God, how did you know that?
We had conversations. I make it my business to know who we are. And I can never forget the great Dr. Maynell Wilson. You know, these men nurtured me. I would never throw them under the bus. I would never throw a great pastor under the bus.
That's amazing. And do you know, I recall my mother took me to Reverend Wilson because I had questions about the church. I wasn't satisfied. I wasn't getting what I needed. And this was at a very early age. But nevertheless, we went and sat in his office. And unfortunately, he didn't have the answers. He didn't have the answers. May Allah forgive his sins and grant him paradise.
May he grant him paradise, because Dr. Wilson was one of the sincere preachers. You know, and Convent Avenue Baptist Church and all families has always had great preachers. I don't know the current pastor, but I do know Reverend Clarence A. Grant, a very, very fine man. I mean, we have to recognize, we as a people will never go anyplace until we are revering the womb from where we came from. And the Arabic word is really, we're not going to have an Arabic class here, but it just means a place of mercy. That's what it really means. When you read the word, you'll
that's
see in the word mercy. So here was a place, the church was a place of mercy, the Temple of Islam was a place of mercy. Now, God, the evolver, has evolved us to another station, and we don't want to forget this other mercy, the mercy of God has given us and full understanding through our beloved leading teacher, Imam W.D. Muhammad. But see, Imam Muhammad unleashed you, and I said me, I'm talking to me personally, so I could respect my Christian roots. Doesn't mean, you know, like I was telling a Christian preacher, he said, well, why did you leave the church? And I want to say this, because I know there are Christians listening or not hiding. I see myself as an evolved Christian, meaning I have evolved out of Christianity, but I still have great respect for it. I have great respect. I will say this in honesty. I am compelled by the rituals of the church, but I'm repulsed by the doctrine of the church. So without getting into it, because I said this kind of provocatively, because I would like one of my Christian friends to ask me a question. I'm sure you're listening. Again, I never will abandon them. I am going to start back even donating to my church that I grew up in. I cannot forget. You know, I went back to my home church, and he asked me to preach. So the lady said, well, you're going to preach at the church? She said, let me ask you this. You still a preacher? I said, Miss Penn, how could I ever forget God that you told me? I said, I'm not a Christian. She said, well, you still believe in God? I said, more so now than when I was in your Sunday school class. And I'm going to tell you what Carl Jung said. He said he no longer believe in God. He knowing God. And that's how I feel. I said, what God has blessed us with as a people, particularly as a community, I will give the rest of my life to share this liberating teaching. I won't be happy to first
what?
41 million of our people get this.
Imam Alfred, you're making me think that we probably need to do an entire show talking about these Christian roots. I think it's an important show because in the current Islamic environment, we have a great number of Muslims coming from a heritage where they are culturally Islamic or culturally Muslim, and then they are trying to practice Islam as a religion. And a lot of people don't appreciate or understand how this Muslim a community has evolved, but we have these strong cultural Christian ties, and I think that deserves a show unto itself. But I really want to thank the caller from Sister Zakia.
Thank you, caller. Thank you so much. May Allah The creed of the heavens and earth will reward you richly for your great work and your great contribution. See, we're never going to be a great people until we can accept each other's great, unique contribution. And, sister, you have done a wonderful and is doing a wonderful job to preserve our work.
Thank you.
Going that analogy between the need to reenact and the opera. That is a wonderful analogy. That was very enlightening to me. And I really, really gives us a lot to think about. So thank you so much.
All of these African tribes. So one of the things I think we need to look at is the Kwanzaa. While I applaud the effort, it's a wrong effort. And the reason I say it's a wrong effort, because we didn't come from from East Africa. We should have something. We have lost connection with West Africa. We need to connect to what went on here in America. We are new people, so our rituals should celebrate how, like the what is it, jumping the broom? That should be a part of our wedding ritual. What stopped us from doing that? What stopped us from collecting traditions of our people? Imam Muhammad said we should collect our tradition. That should be a book under the Quran, under the life example of Prophet Hadi. Then that should be a collection of African-American traditions. And our children should be given that book when they come into womanhood, when they come into manhood. And we should have dances, wedding dances. We should have graduation dances, opening business dances, with music and trumpets and, yes.
We have another caller, 856, and please forgive me. I think I disconnected our last two callers accidentally. So if there's any way that they can call back in if they want to continue to listen to the show. But we have an 856 caller. You are on the air.
856, is that me?
That's you.
Okay, this is Ibrahim from New Jersey calling in. It's a blessing to be here.
Thank you,
Ibrahim from New Jersey.
Okay, I'm calling to just to comment on the concept of reenactment in theater, and I just wanted to make the statement that my perception of theater is theater has historically been a powerful tool to be used by those who recognize it, and I say that because in light of if you study the Romans when the Romans conquered. And they wanted to quell an uprising or distract any masses from organizing against their oppression. One of the things that they typically did was ramp up the theater as a distraction to take people to a place and control them in a way that was would delude the masses from their agenda, you know, and the flip side of that, like anything, when you have any tool or weapon, always has two sides to how it can be used. And I say that because, as Imam Alfred alluded to, the African traditions have shown the use of theater to perpetuate messages, to galvanize, and to order masses and groups. And if you look at our history here in the United States, from the slave period, even up until recently, one of the medicinal methods by which people healed, one of the methods by which people communicated things unknown and was through music and through the use of music and theater as a method. And I like to even mention as most recently, as the last poets, and as Brother Ismail alluded to, Public Enemy and KRS-One and people like that who are perpetuating positive messages by the use of music. I think the industry as a whole has recognized that and has utilized that tool against us to oppress or suppress what they recognize to be a movement that was gaining momentum through the use of music, because I think the introduction of hip-hop and that phenomenon started and was the continuation of an uprising that came out of the civil rights movement and was taking form in a way that if they recognized it needed to be stopped. And I feel like the industry as a whole has subjugated that tool and is using it against us. And I think the consciousness about that will allow us to regain the use of that tool and apply the philosophy as described by Imam Alfred of the medicinal use of theater and communication through music, and it's in our blood, it's in our history, and it's in our DNA to do that. And I think it'll be a powerful thing to actually take advantage of that, recognize it for what it is, and use it as a way of healing our community.
Well, thank you so much for that. And Imam Alfred, I want to share with you that at the Islamic convention, we had a little gathering to talk about some of the traumatic experiences that are going on in our neighborhoods and the terrible suffering that families are going through. And we really wanted to try to connect Muslims and people of all faiths all over the country to really get serious about this. And an idea came up that I had thought about myself, but I thought about it from a different perspective. Imam Qasim Ahmed had mentioned in the keynote speech that he wanted to have a year-long campaign to change the word environment and to put language. Imam Muhammad spent so much time making us aware of how important language is to the way our societies develop. And we know that Scripture says that Jesus was a word. And we know that Imam Muhammad taught us that words make people. And I thought that was a wonderful idea. I actually had thought about doing the same thing with billboards. I was trying to imagine what kind of billboards, if we were able to go into all of these neighborhoods and put new words into the language environment. And I've been really toying with them. And then when Imam Qasim Ahmed talked about taking, you know, the placards, the things that we use for political campaigns, and putting a word in the environment, asking neighbors and people to accept to put these words on their lawn, just like you would put for somebody that you were supporting for a campaign. What if we did that? And I really loved the idea, and I had the idea, but it was much more expensive as you know, renting billboards. So this is more cost effective. But if we did that, what kind of words or word phrases would we use? And if there are any callers out there that have any ideas or suggestions, we have about 15 more minutes. You can call in at 805-727-7013. And let us know if you have any ideas what words should be used to recreate the word environment to change the way we function as a community. So, Imam Alfred, you can go first. And then if the caller...
I think that some of those words we can really just take from the court. I think if we were to walk in these neighborhoods, I'm really wanting, before this year it's out, I'm having a strong urge to get a group of men, 25, we need a number. It's good. Numbers, and numbers is strength. I mean, it's just no question about numbers as being vitally important. And we should walk with signs that saying God has created you in the best mode. We should also talk about dignity of work. We should say something about peace. We should, but they should. We can have Quranic verses. But people, it would grab their attention if you went into the downtown section where the gathering crowds, and you would just walk through these neighborhoods with those signs. Because you know what Imam Muhammad said one time to me? He said, a lot of our people will never come to our mosque. They're not going to come. Our people are claustrophobic. So we need to go to them. Go right in the neighborhoods like this street corner speakers used to be, go rather. And, you know, you've been created in the best mode. You're not created junk, whatever. But I just think, you know, we can have committees. I'll read that to people. There are people who have thoughts and ideas that they should come up with these ideas. We should go in these neighborhoods with that.
Well, Imam Alfred, I think the question has gotten some other guests intrigued. If you will hold on, 856, we have a caller from area code 347 that I think wants to weigh in on the question. Area code 347, you are on the air.
As-salamu alaykum, my sister and my brother Imam Alfred. How y'all doing?
Well, thank you, my salam.
My brother Imam, my
yes,
man,
sir.
That's my brother. Listen to you, man, and I know a lot of the things that you're saying because I was with you in Chicago when we went out there. I drove me, you, and your son. You was invited to come out to be the keynote speaker at the Patriotism Day and to give that first Sunday talk at the mosque. And, Buddy, ma'am, one thing that I noticed about you before you and I or work together is how you change your name, the spelling of your name, Billy Man. That's when I recognize that you see the importance of language. You know, because your name used to be spelled Muhammad, then you change your name to spell the way Imam Muhammad said his name was spelled on his birth certificate, Muhammad. Most of the Muslim in our community in the Muslim world have not yet understood what Imam Muhammad told President Bill Clinton in 1986 when he went down to Wilmer, Virginia, and was standing on the banks of the Wilmer River, where they brought the first slave ships over on. And Imam Muhammad asked Mr. President Bill Clinton, could he take time to clear up his mother and father's name? He said, go right ahead, Mr. Muhammad. So the Imam said, they went and bought my father's driver license to me. And on my father's driver license, his name was spelled Muhammed. So he said, why is I'm telling you this, Mr. President? He said, because on my birth certificate, my mother's and father's name was signed on my birth certificate when I was born as Wallace D. Muhammad. Their name was spelled that way, Muhammed. So he said, the reason why I'm telling you this, Mr. President, because the first three letters in medicine is M-E-D. He said, that's the last three letters in my name is M-E-D, mm-hmm. M-O-H-A. He said, I am the Muhammad with the medicine.
Right.
I am not the mad Muhammad with his last three letters spelled in his name mean mad. Now, Brother Imam, when the Imam will come before the community on during the month of Ramadan, he would look out in the audience. He said, majority of you are still Christian. Don't you know Muhammad, Muhammad, it keep us connected to Christianity. It keep us connected to the Trinitarian doctrine. It keep us connected to man as being God, because that's the name that was presented to us from the man who brought the religion here, whose name was spelled Muhammad, Farad Muhammad, and we was taught that that's God in a person. So all of those people that hold on to that name, spelling Muhammad, they are Christian Muslim. And also the good side about this here, it proves that Christ Jesus and all the rest of the prophets was Muslim, because female mother and father came out of Christianity. They came out of Christianity. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Farah Muhammad, gave him the name Kareem, meaning generous. He said, the Holy Prophet, Mr. Farah, you gave my brother Kalat the name Muhammad. He said, I like that name too. So being that we are of the same family, we would like to keep our family connected. And so that's when Farah Muhammad gave him the name Elijah Muhammad. And from that point, history was made. So all of my brothers and sisters in the Muslim world, the shaitan said this. He's going to embarrass the human being. He's going to prove that he was not worthy. And the Imam said that in scripture, where it says, seven eyes went out to prove that man was not worthy to receive the great blessing that God was going to bestow on them. And so seven eyes went out to prove that man was worthy. So the national headquarters under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, where we had the representative, the national spokesman at Temple number seven. But there was a great another temple that was in Brooklyn called Temple 7C. And really, Minister Arthur Fortinet, they had the biggest cause, the biggest followers in New York was in Brooklyn. So we had a meeting, Buddy Man, up in Mount Vernon. And Earl Abdul-Malik had gained residency man at that time. So Imam Shamsuddin, he gave a helpful strategy of how to up the Muslim Journal. So I stood up and told him, I'm representing Brooklyn, and I'm going to take 250 people myself. And Lassay stood up and said, I'm going to take another 250. So I said, well, we ahead of most all the masters and paper selling there, because between us two, that's 500 right there. That's 500 people, a Muslim journal right there. So, Brother Mel, I'm saying this because I appreciate you, Brother Mel, because you are fighting a battle. And you know these people. I was surprised of how when we went to Chicago, a lot of people knew you, Brother Imam. And I know that you. I know. I travel with you, and I know that you are aware of the mental sick condition that our people is. And Honorable Elijah Muhammad said his job was to resurrect the mentally dead. The mentally dead. So when we look at that name, M-U-H-A, they pronounced it Mud. Mud. Imam said they were. So when his father started out in 1930. They were spelling their name, M-O-H-A-M-M-E-D, and it was not until 1952 when an unscrupulous Palestinian, he came among us, you know, because Honorable Elijah Muhammad put out in a paper he needed some help, and he wanted Arabic-speaking people. So the man said, that guy that came down, he wasn't morally tight. So he was one of the ones convinced Honorable Elijah Muhammad of how to pronounce he was to start calling ourselves mud people. You mean I'm saying he was calling himself Wallace D. Mud up until the age of 14. He said up in 1952, that's when they changed the spelling of the name from M-O-H-H-M-M-E-D to M-U-H-H-M-M-E-D. And at the name of the at the end of the name, the Shaitan, he said, I'm gonna get him. I'm gonna come from their left to right, before them, from behind them, and I'm gonna prove that they not. That name is designed to embarrass the African American descendants of slaves. And Farrakhan had all of his followers to change their name to Muhammad, M-U-H-A-M-M-A-D, and at the end of the name is spelled Mad. So we got a group of sincere African American descendants of slaves that have been tricked, like they have always tricked us. And keep us like the syphilis of Prince Principle. Every time we try to get up the hill, they bring something to our memory, and bring us back all the way back down. Email said, we don't need no beginning, no more. He said, we need a finish. And I think you
let
know
how to ask
brother,
you, brother.
Let me just say that. Say what?
If you could pick one phrase to put on these placards to try to hold up the language.
The first thing I would do is correct the name, the spelling of the name Muhammad. That's the first thing I would do. I would put on the. Okay. I would let them know the difference meaning of the word Muhammad. Not I would let them know one of them mean mad
excellent.
And the other one mean
excellent.
The one with the medicine. And Imam Muhammad say, I am the Muhammad with the medicine. Thank you very kindly.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much. We have another caller on the line, and I'm not sure if we finish with the 856. Since you were so patient, if you want to weigh in on this 856, you can tell us what you would put on those placards if you could change the language environment in the community that you see the need for. 856, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Do you think that there are some words that you would put out if you could ask your neighbors or the people in Philadelphia or Southside Chicago to put these placards up, what language, what words would you put it up? We only have about 5 more minutes, but I'd like to get you and 2 more callers.
Okay. I think the concept of piercing intellect would be something I would like to see to inspire
the words piercing intellect?
Yes.
And why do you pick those words, if you can in 15 seconds tell us?
Because the words themselves provoke you to thought. It provokes you to apply your intellect in a deeper way.
So kind of to whet the appetite. All right.
Correct.
Thank you so much, 856. And I'm going to pick up a caller in 917. If you could share with us your thoughts on what words we could get out there to kind of change the word environment. 973, I'm sorry.
Yes, alaikum
assalam.
Alaikum assalam. I would suggest the word of do for self. I think that's one of the most needed words that we need in our environment, in African American community today. Do for self.
If we can program our people to think
do for self, then we can do a lot of other things.
I agree with that. That's so powerful. Thank you so much for that, brother. I would make that my top.
I agree with the brother as well.
And we have one more 917 number out there. Can you tell us what words you would put out of the environment before we get ready to close out?
Assalamu alaikum. One more time. I would do Do For Self, but I would add Do For Self and Khan, because that was actually mentioned in the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's book. And in places like Philadelphia, some people sometimes they got that phrase in the street, and it means sometimes just to do what you gotta do, like by any means necessary. And I think that if you read,
it to be a selfish thing.
Even the nation, I like to see that more social economics, like with the Khan situation. And then one other name, I definitely think we're new people. So New Africa, when you build a complex or you build a store or restaurant to signal that we are new people, and a lot of our people that's burning us. But then I also think we need a place where we can talk to the youth about names that are already there that are borrowed, and let them see the result, you know, just let them shine. Because a lot of the youth, when I speak to most young people, I come down to their level. And that's what makes me a little bit successful with talking to young people, because I first talk about the things they already know and open up a comfort zone. So in hip-hop and in general, a lot of people are using Muslim terms. Like one of the biggest concepts in the Quran tells us Islam is peace. It's more than any other religion. I see Christianity being more love. But most of the young people don't say love. You know what I mean? They say peace. You know, well, peace. You know, hip-hop, that's when it was growing. They say one peace. And even the love that they have, they say one love. That came from Muslim being one God, one love, one humanity. So a lot of things I would like us to at least to even come down and show the influence Islam has had in the culture when it was going a certain direction. And I think that a lot of our young people don't realize how influential it is. And then you could celebrate those things. All right.
Well, that's powerful. Thank you. And I think that's a powerful, very important for us to realize. You're absolutely right. A lot of the language from Islamic culture, African-American Islamic culture, from the Quran even, is already out there, but people have assigned different meanings to it, and we need to reclaim that language. So that's really, really valuable. So thank you so much for that. And Imam Alfred, I have to say that we didn't really get to quite a few things that I wanted to interview you about. So, we have only a couple of more minutes. And I just want to let everybody know that if you want to make a donation to the Ministry of Religion Meets Alive for actually Imam Alfred Muhammad's ministry, to donate to 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. And Imam Alfred, I hope you will agree to let me bring you on again so that we can talk in more depth.
I think that we need, in light of what the sister said, most people in the community really don't know me. And if my role is to be a servant of the community, is to be known, and I want to serve more, the community more, and to use my skills, not to be over people, but to facilitate our community coming together again, I want to tell the people that we are the greatest people on earth, and I don't mean this in a racial sense, what we've gone through. You know, when you've gone through 4 years of college, you have a bachelor's degree. Well, we've had 4 years, 400 years to qualify this. Then we had a master because we have survived it. And I think we're working on a PhD. I said the Caucasian slave master gets an A for inflicting the most horrific treatment ever known to man. We also get an A for surviving that. Pardon me?
You and I really want to see you be able to connect with more people so that you can bring your message. So I'm really hoping that you will be successful with your ministry and that you will be able to educate more young people who want to be have the training that you have. And I hope that you have some plans for doing some training in the future.
Yes, I do. I certainly do. I was saying. It's interesting you would just say that because I just left the meeting at New York Theological Seminary. Well, we're hoping to start a class in leadership training. And I'm going to say this, if Dr. Dale Irvin is listening, I hope he's not, but we are interested in eventually having our own seminary. We have to have a place where we can train our leaders, where we can train our counselors, where we can train our people. We need a Muslim teachers college. Desperate.
Well, I'm glad that you have that in your agenda, and I just wanted to give you the opportunity to share with your audience in the last 30 seconds what your next show is going to be about.
Well, the next show, I'm not going to actually be on the show. It will be with, oh, well, I mean, yes, Brother Nazim Rashid will be doing a show called Reconnecting Thursday. That will be at 6 o'clock. Thursday we will have a show with a healthcare professional.
Is that tomorrow?
It's called Reconnect with Nazim Rashid. And Friday, Yusuf Abdul Bar. I'm going to be back on the air on Saturday. And I would ask, really, I invite Sister Amadurah, Sister Coral. You're such a great interviewer. I have had some people to interview me, but you have done
my pleasure and
marvelous and spectacular job. And I was going to invite you back if you would sit in the studios next Tuesday to continue. I would like to have this as a regular dialogue with our people, but at least the next 2 months. And
well, I hope to be back. I hope to be back, and I'm going to sign you all off and tell you that it was an honor and delight to be a guest host on Religion Means a Lot.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.